Just to make sure that you know where you are, this is poetry and back scratching's next door. So make sure you're not in the wrong spot. I said that very casually last week and half the people got up and went in there. So I was almost tempted not to be honest and tell you, but that's where he is. Well, I'm going to read some poems. I've been reading everybody else's for the last 2 weeks and read some Frost and Longfellow and Dylan Thomas and T.S. Eliot and everybody. We've done plays and we've done this and that, so tonight I'm going to read my own. And since it's a small group, I hope you'll be relaxed enough to ask questions if you want to, make some comments. There's nothing sacred about a poetry reading, at least not mine, certainly not at Holden. So just relax and say whatever you'd like to say. I'll read two or three poems and stop and see if you want to ask anything, okay? Anything you always wanted to ask a poet but never had the chance, well, now you've got the chance. These poems come from a long time of writing, and I think probably the greatest... I guess she knows that. For the most part, they tend to be set in the Midwest and Illinois, Nebraska, that sort of area. Even though I live in Southern California, I've been there for 1,000 years, it seems like. My roots are from a farm in Southern Illinois, so that's where most of the things tend to come from. Or a composite of Midwest. I taught a couple of years at a small college in Nebraska, at Seward, Nebraska. Isn't a Nebraskan here? Oh, well, there's more than I forgot. There's more than one in the village. Yeah. I lived in Seward for a couple of years, about 30 miles from Lincoln. So there's some poems there. Okay, let me start off with a poem called Soon. This is a little premature, but I was coming back from the trail junction today and seemed I could smell the air changing, and I didn't see any trees changing, but it made me think of this poem. This poem's called Soon, and it's about the change of the seasons when you go from fall is there and it's just around the corner, is going to be winter. And how many of you are from the Midwest in here? Well, and Easter, yeah. So you'll know about this. Sometimes the kids in Southern California, you can read this sort of a poem and sort of a blank look. When you go from, September is our hottest month, usually, instead of where I am. And October, it may get down to maybe 75 in the daytime. Although I have seen kids playing Frisbee on Christmas Day and New Year's Day in Kingsman Park, where I teach. But maybe you'll resonate with some of these images soon. The time is at last the right time. The autumn leaves are banked against the soft maples by the pasture's edge. And we have all but put away the hand tools, the mower, and the soft clothes of summer are hanging on pegs or folded in boxes labeled easy access in a large closet we had put in beneath the cellar stairs. It is at last the right time. The season of apples and cider and ducks high in the pearl gray sky, flying to hidden ponds we only guessed at and never once saw or heard anyone else seeing. Soon the lights down the road will look yellow in the kitchen windows, and the flowers in the Union Grove Cemetery will wilt in the iron ground. At dusk, the smoke of burning leaves will be rose-colored and rise easily into the windless sky, while somewhere beyond Mill Creek, a coyote will bark twice in the crisping air. Tonight it will not snow, but soon it will fall and cover the yellow windows. It will put out the fires in the fields and yards and cover the wilted flowers. Soon what I see will lie quiet under soft snow. Soon the sky will throw hard lines around the earth, and I will, in some fantastic manner, die, or seem to die, in that cold, quiet way animals seem to disappear. And the trees will fall asleep in amp in silver light. It has not happened yet, but soon. So there may be some images that you'll recognize. A year ago this month was an odd time, a traumatic time. We sold a house and bought a house. I've never done that before. I hope I never have to do it again. You know what moving is like. Moving an entire house and garage was something else again. I found, I hauled away, I have an old 72 Ford pickup truck, which hopefully will still kick over when I get back to Fields Point Landing. And I hauled away at least probably a dozen truckloads of stuff and dumped them. And they've been living in that house and garage for 10 years, very contentedly in little nooks and things. I thought, why is it that I was keeping space for 10 loads of stuff? But you know how it is when you clean out the garage on a Saturday or once in the summer. I would take out things and say, what's this? Where did it come from? Whose is it? What do we do with it? I've never seen it before. And then put it right back up on the shelf. It'll come in handy. If we ever move, I can use that box. It'll hold just this object, which you don't have, of course. But anyway, we pared down a little. Selling the house was a pain, as I suppose it inevitably is. Here's a poem called Selling the House. You know, the people coming in and looking around. They raise fingers to the ceiling and arch eyebrows as if to say, ah, look there. The little girl in the red overalls has slipped into the fish pond. Her grandmother hasn't seen it yet. Tomorrow we refinance our house in order to pay someone more money than we should because we don't qualify for something else. I've lost track. And then we will give another $165 to tell us our house is not worth what we want to refinance it for. The baby finches are barely out of the nest, and they're not used to other people staring at their nakedness. What's this plant? A man asks. He drops his cigarette ashes on the new grass I planted after last year's dog ruined the yard. I don't like all these rocks. This ain't Connecticut. Upstairs, I put on Mahler's First Symphony and turn it up. That and the fan allow me a little comfort as they troop in and out, upstairs and down, peeking into my study where I smile and type and grin at the little kids. The grandmother has discovered pond slime on her granddaughter's topsiders bought just yesterday at the Summer Madness sale. The realtor tells them, very quietly, that there could just possibly be, pause, creative financing. I listen for the hushed intake of breath. Nothing. And they are gone. The realtor says he will take down the signs and the little yellow flags which says, we are home, come in. And it's quiet. Mahler is winding up. The late afternoon breezes are beginning off the ocean, rolling beyond the Santa Monica Mountains where hawks go upstairs and downstairs without ever once wiping their feet or financing anything. selling the house. Selling the house, yeah. One more in that vein, since I'm on selling the house, and here it is. It's called New... I raise birds in the backyard. I have finches and doves, peace doves, and parakeets of all kinds of odd descriptions. And two little button quail from China, little bitty things that scuttle about and serve no useful purpose at all that I could have been able to discover. They're always there. So anyway, this is new finches, new doves. They are fuzzballs on slender branches. They dance in dappled light from ash trees whose roots seek out our plumbing and inch their knobby knuckles across the seeded lawn. Their chirps are darts tangy as asterisks. And when I come near, the mother dove eyes me with her pink eyes, cocking her head to one side. The male dove watches the female, his neck puffing and swelling, waiting for her. The people walk through the yard, wanting to buy the house and find the birds. What's in there? A woman pulls a little girl back. A bird flew right into my face when I was a girl, terror leaking out of her eyes. While the new finches and new doves flip and dance beneath light shards falling from the sun breaking in the tall trees. Well, we finally sold the house, and now I have a bigger aviary. It's 18 feet long and 11 feet wide and 8 feet high. And the birds have room to do their little birdie thing, and they do it all the time. In fact, just before I left to come up here, I removed the nest boxes. The doves are too ponderous and dull-witted to care much, and the quail are on the ground anyway, but the budgies, the parakeets, were incensed that I took out their nest boxes. They just chirped and scattered and sassed and all the time. But out they came because they were producing faster than I can get rid of them. Anybody want a bird, write to me at CLC. I'll put one in a sack and mail it to you. Here's a poem called Not Like Iowa. Anybody from Iowa? It's all right. It usually is. Fall this year will be late, I suspect. The barrancas are so dry now, you can't imagine water running over the old cracks or whirling around the oak roots that bite into the clay cliffs. Still, someone will probably smell rain, they'll say. Oh, not like Iowa, of course. Surely. Surely I misunderstood you last night. It was during the news, and words were falling out of people around me, and the Democrats were making a joyful noise, but you know how it is. Your ears pick up things like a good dog sniffs them out, and your voice above the rest saying, well, yes, but we'll be married 30 years next March, just like that. Summer. Where does it say August nights have to be so hot? The old dog hears me and thumps her tail on the floor. If I look at her, I'll have to get right down there with her. The kid across the street has just about mastered the drums. Just about. And tonight on our walk, I wondered at the cool breeze I felt when we turned at those big poplars. No doubt it's hot in Illinois, too. My dad will be dozing in his chair, the farm dazzling in moonlight. Well, there's, by way of introduction, a few poems.
What was the last word of that last poem?
The farm will be dazzling in moonlight. Yeah. Inevitably, when I come up to Holden, the tailing dust gets in my throat, and it gets harder and harder to talk. In fact, it's better now. The second day I was in, I was reading something, and I could hardly talk. Stuff comes out of there. Sometimes it affects vocal cords. It does mine all the time. I gave a reading up here once about 10 years ago. And it was so bad, and everybody, the village had a sore throat. Like, a few days ago it was the flu, and the staff were dropping like flies of the flu. And this was sore throat. And I had rags around my throat, and various doctors in the village were saying, try this. And it finally got so bad, all I could do was whisper, and he had to tape the mic right here. That was a very awkward thing.
Got a phone button?
Not yet. Okay, one more from this. These are some new poems I'm just doing. It's called Dolly. We lived on the farm in Southern Illinois. We had some workhorses, perch and mares. You know what they are? They're big, big guys, big, broad backs. I used to sit on them, and my feet would go straight out. They wouldn't drop down. And the big hoofs, you know, each hoof was about as big around as this thing, it seemed to me. And the biggest and the oldest and the best was Dolly. And that's what the poem is called. The poem opens up, the persona would be myself as a child, speaking to or about my father. You sounded the same as when you hauled out the stumps when Dolly, the big horse, pulled against her harness, and you watched her, eased her into the leather until it cracked and almost snapped. Still you urged her, your hand against her heaving side, catching the foam fleck on your face. The same voice now, telling her she could move them, calling her honey, holding the upper lip away from the gun barrel. She didn't resist, tasting a harness bit, expecting the slap of leather against her neck. And my uncle turning me between the horse's red eyes and the red fireball sun breaking on the timber across the pond. When the shot came, his hand tightened on my shoulder, but I was already running, finding the fence through the salt tears, screaming into that blazing sun, seeing the trees catch fire, the blood running down the dark woods spreading out before me, your voice behind me, the same voice calling me back. Any questions?
I kind of missed something on that point. The gun barrel, I was kind of picturing this horse working and then all of a sudden it
happened. Yeah, yeah.
And I assumed that the horse was eliminated.
Right. Yep, you didn't miss a trick. Yeah.
But that seemed to be quite a transition.
Yeah, there was. It's abrupt. And I meant it that way.
That's how it affected you as a child or your recollection.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in addition to trying to speak through the as a child, remember as a child, to my father, whose voice, the same voice, could want me to come back and sit on his knee, could also tell the horse not to worry, I'm going to blow your brains out, that sort of thing. But also trying to get in a little bit the persona of the horse, expecting, so used to work, expecting the harness or the something, and then not really noticing that he's putting the gun barrel in their mouth.
Could I go back to that first point you read?
Sure.
And there was a transition there about the flowers going into the iron hard ground.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just that that ground is that way that time of year? Just
yeah, I was thinking in late November maybe. Gets maybe early frost and gets hard. You know.
Was there any, what was you doing towards the end of that point, do you recall? There seemed to be a transition from into fall, but I sense a transition of an impending death or a finality of life,
yeah,
or something, and I wasn't sure what.
I think that's probably implied in almost any poem, or that's, I don't know, I don't have the right to say that about other poets, but for me, any poet about that time of year, the change, November, January, it's the end of things. Whether you're talking about wilted flowers or people, it's things that's dying. And there's always that sort of impending disaster or doom. Let me switch, because now you've made me think of something. And I promised Tom I was going to read him a Frost poem. This is a good time to do it, isn't it? I said I wasn't going to read anybody but me tonight, and here I'm reading Robert Frost. I guess Frost won't mind, and I suppose you won't either, will you? Tom here is from New Hampshire.
Originally.
Now he's at Holden. This is Reluctance, just about one of my favorite Frost poems. It talks about that sort of a thing, I think. Reluctance. Out through the fields and the woods and over the walls I have wended. I have climbed the hills of view and looked at the world and descended. I have come by the highway home, and lo, it is ended. The leaves are all dead on the ground, save those that the oak is keeping, to ravel them one by one and let them go scraping and creeping out over the crusted snow when others are sleeping. And the dead leaves lie huddled and still, no longer blown hither and thither. The last lone aster is gone. The flowers of the witch hazel wither. The heart is still aching to seek, but the feet question whither. Ah, when to the heart of man was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with the grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love or a season? That's for you, Tom.
Thank you.
Now, if I could find Ptarmigan Traverse for Dan. We spent kind of a family reunion back there last Christmas in Greenville, Illinois. Which is 50 miles east of St. Louis. Those of you, anybody from St. Louis? I say, I can't call that God's country. If you've been anywhere near St. Louis, you know. It's just not true. somebody else may live there some. But it's a nice place, and Southern Illinois is very nice. And all my relatives are hard-shelled Baptists and Methodists, free Methodists, they're quick to point out, as opposed to the enslaved ones, I suppose. But it's a different ball game there. And we were back to this Christmas when it set all kinds of records for snow. I suppose you followed some of that. And almost every day, it was probably a minimum of 50 below zero wind chill. And it got up to almost 90 below wind chill, which is unheard of in that area. Just set 100-year-old records. Well, there's no way to have a family reunion. And my father has a little trailer out on 15 acres, almost in the path of the railroad, as far as I could tell, every night when it came through. And with a trailer full of people and kids and my granddaughter sleeping in a Kmart crate that he had put on the floor. And when we left, we were getting ready to go back to the airport to fly out. We gathered down my uncle's farmhouse about a half mile down the road. And it was just blizzard outside, and my uncle looked at me and says, "You want to hold the ice for me?" I looked at him, I said, "Do I want to wet the ice for you?" He says, "Hold it." He looked at me, kind of scratched his little head, his little bib overalls on, wriggling his feet. Jimmy swaggered on the telly. My aunt making cobbler pies. She looked at me to see if I wanted to hold the ice. I hadn't any idea what they were talking about. I said, "Sure." He says, good, the axe is out behind the chicken house. I still didn't know what that meant. Holy ice. If there's an axe involved, I assume he must want me to chop a hole in the ice. So then on the way out the door, I paused and I asked the inevitable question. I says, why do you want me to chop a hole in the ice? And he looked at me. He says, like, you dumb Californian, so the fish can breathe. And I said, oh. And I went out, and on the way out there, I thought, wait a minute, fish don't have to have a hole in the ice to breathe. I thought, well, these are Illinois fish. What do I know? So I went out there, and I was out there chopping, and the wind blowing and scarf flying, and I couldn't even find the pond for a while because it all looked the same. I assumed I was on a pond. I was out there for 30 minutes. I finally hit ice, and it took me another 10 minutes to get through a little hole. And as soon as I turned my back, and he would yell, put a post in it so it won't freeze up. And I would go back and I'd grab a post and I'd jam it in. And after I got to thinking about it, I could just see him in there chuckling to himself and say, look at him out there chopping a hole in the ice so the fish can breathe. Which I did. I don't know. I still don't know if he was serious. There's no way to tell my Uncle Luther whether he was serious or not. But my Aunt Emma, who was making the cobblers, I knew she was serious, and if I didn't do that, I would not get any cobbler. It's the same kind of question like, do you want to hold the ice? Do you want to watch Jimmy Swagger? Say no, it's no cobbler. Forget it. I watched 2 weeks worth of old Jimmy. I watched him bend that microphone and sweat and play the piano. My Aunt Emma says, he preaches real good, don't he? I said, you bet. Pass the cobbler. At the end of 2 weeks, I thought he did preach pretty well. Another Lutheran bites the dust. Anyway, this is the poem, Holing the Ice. Morning, the ice is thick on the pond, and my uncle will ask me to chop holes so the fish can breathe. The few chickens he has are still as death and watch me climb the fence to the pond. Last night's storm has covered the ice with snow, and I pretend I don't know where the ice is, dreaming a miracle of being on water, wanting to dance or yell, but I know my uncle watches from the kitchen window to see if I put the poles in so the ice won't freeze shut. So I swing the ice, and the ice splinters in silver needles, but there is no hole. I swing and swing, driving the axe deeper down, cleaving the hard rock ice, listening to the echoes of the axe from across the timber where hunters were heard yesterday. There is brief sun as my axe finds water. It hits my face, biting my hands, but it feels good. So I swing again and again and again, biting back, digging whole chunks of ice out, gouging the axe into the cold, dark hole, sweating as the ice showers over me, humming sounds with the axe, burning with the silver shards, fanning the frosty morning air with my swing, bathing in the brutal joy of swinging. Then when the posts are in place, I leave without looking back, knowing the ice will freeze over, sensing the dark, whole fish hovering wonderfully awake, not knowing if they will last until spring, remembering only the swinging. You never know where it's going to go or when a poem comes from. You know, on the one hand, the story of my uncle asking me to do this is funny in a way, and yet the poem turned out to be quite another thing. It turned out to be very serious, and it turned out to say something that I hadn't intended. Seems to me, still not. I guess you're never sure exactly what that is that's there. Best thing to do is get out of the way and let it say what it's going to say, and let some critic in the year 2000 say, about that poem. Of course, the critic, God bless him, will never know about my little uncle scratching his head watching Jimmy Swaggart and the pies, but you do. Critics don't need to know so much anyway. As Carl Sandburg said, the lawyers, Bob, know too much. Okay. Anything, comments or questions? Yeah.
I had a question. In terms of, you know, getting an English literature class, and the teacher starts coming up with all these different levels of meaning and stuff, and the symbolism and stuff. And how much credit can we give to that kind of, you know?
Depends what kind of a grade you want, probably.
Yeah. When you're writing, are you more going with the flow? what were you intentionally thinking of all those different interpretations that they give?
I don't think anybody, if he's serious, would say that he or she knows exactly everything that's going into what they're doing.
Yeah.
I think you know pretty well. You're in control of the material. You're the writer. It's silly to say that you're just an automatic writer, although I've known people that say that, but I think that's pretty rare. Somewhere, it seems to me, I don't want to make a big speech out of this, but it seems to me all art, writing, dance, music, sculpture, painting, collage, whatever, has three parts to it. That sounds like Lutheranism, but it's got three parts. What else could it have? First of all, if I write a poem, that I know what it's about. I wrote it. On the other hand, I can't tell exactly what everything is. There's some subconscious things working that I may have not even be aware of, right? You come to the poem or the sculpture or the dance or the music, and when you hear a symphony or go to a museum or whatever, or see the sunset going down over, or the moon coming up over the Buckskin, that's your moon. It's your aesthetic experience. It doesn't matter what I think the poem means or the music, it's yours. So there's a paradox. Now to compound that, the art itself, the poem, the sculpture, the music, is somewhere spinning in the center. I partake of half of it because I wrote it. You partake of half of it because you bring your own experiences to it. But neither one of us can completely own it. There's something magic in the middle, and that's what art is. I don't know if that clouded the water, but say that in a graduate class, and the prof will say, oh, this is tedious stuff. Why are you saying I was giving a report on Herman Melville's poems once in a graduate class at USC. And I was saying, now this is he uses hard words in this line and some soft words in this line. And pretty soon the prof says, wait a minute, what do you mean hard words? I said, well, they're words like dirt and dig, soft words like soft, slush, sounds soft. He says, what critics do you have to back up that? Who else has said those words are hard or soft? I said, well, I don't know. It seems obvious that dig is hard and soft sounds soft to me. And I could tell that didn't wash. He looked at me and looked at me. God forbid you should voice your own opinion without having a bibliography to back that up. That was the beginning of the end, that fellow and me. I tell my students, just in answer to your question again, that they should always interpret any art subjectively. What does it do for you? It makes you feel good or sad, happy or puzzled, whatever. It's your ball game. However, if you're dealing with something that's been around a long time, like Shakespeare or Chaucer or Milton or whomever, and if you're in school, it would behoove you to go to the library and find out what other people have thought over the last 500 years, rather than just say, I think it means this, I don't care what the last 1,000 years have said. On the other hand, if you think it means this, and you do your work in the library, and you say, I now know what a lot of people have thought, but I still think it means this, then I'll say, good, you go with that. As long as I know you've been over there, that's fine. I'm not going to try to change their mind. Art is subjective. Shakespeare is not here to define everything anyway, so we might as well do it. Okay, enough of that. Here's a trilogy. I'm just going to read the last two. I wish you could see these illustrations by a fellow named Jerry Bremer, who's a very fine painter, this book. This is an auction. All the people gathered around, they're selling things. They've got all the crocks over here and the chairs and things over here and the couches. Oh, it's up here. And all kinds of tools. You know what auctions are like. We used to go to a lot of Nebraska. So this first poem is the auction. Everything's gone. Now I'm just going to read the home and the death, the last two. After all the stuff's gone, then the old people have to go. You know, after 57 years in Wilbur, Nebraska, then they've got to go to Laguna Niguel, Southern California, or Fun City. I almost said Sin City, Fun City, Florida, Sun City, or something. Or maybe it would be Sin City. I don't know. I just taught two elder hostel classes at CLC before I came up here, and I've never heard so many ribald jokes from those folks in my life. Once they got cranked up. So anyway, the old people have to go, and the home is where they go, and very often, you know, and that's what this poem, the home. The hot morning sun sucked the shadow off the wide board porch where the old woman rocked. The bustle in the house was noisier than necessary, but she rocked the same for all the talk that hung heavy on the August air. From her porch, she could see the ladies gather across the graveled street, their heads bonneted and bent in the trellis shade. Her long bony hands tightened on the smooth brown rocker arms. She shuffled her feet on the porch and lifted a yellow handkerchief to her throat, then let it drop to her lap. The sun spun in a mazy light, white motions in the beams that struck the hot roof of the pickup that bumped the ditch and rolled to a stop at the porch. The driver smiled a wide, clean smile and said, "Ma'am," as he leaped the steps and banged through the screen door. The old lady tried to say something as he jumped the steps, but he moved too fast in the sun, his face blurred in the web of years that held her in her chair. The ladies in the shade looked up as the family started out the door, formal like an odd parade. They marked the ties, the old blue suit, the fans, the brooch, and how they passed the chair but turned in awkward angles to look before they got in cars. The old woman rocked and rubbed one hand upon the other and felt she ought to tell them of her dresses that they folded in the truck. And the ladies on the swing cried, "Hush," and "Come out and see now," to others in the house across the street. The sun came up the steps. The chair rocked, but slower. And turning once, she saw the neighbor's cat lying quiet in the gladiolas watching the soft brown birds dancing in the bird bath. And she kept looking at the cat and the birds as she was lifted from the chair, her back held firm by long, strong arms, her head against his chest, the world moving around her as she watched. And all the world there was sat quiet across the street as the trellis vine stirred slightly in the darkness of the porch. Okay, and the last of this trilogy is called The Death. She tried. They had fixed her up a room like that she'd left. They gave her sun in afternoons and allowed the fern brought by a cousin. The canary, a gift from the sun, did not live long, but still she tried. The few pictures in her album were rounded at the edges from handling. She combed her long gray hair, brushed it, set the favorite comb, and went to bed. And the first long winter passed without a mark or sign to show she'd ever been anywhere but there. Then the spring and the hot summer. And when the trees turned yellow in the wood, she closed the door and sat on the creaking bed. She didn't cry or move at all, nor ask for dinner when they came at 5. But only passed one hand across her hair to make it neat for anyone who came. No one did. An early snow covered nearly all the ground the day they buried her. The sun stood by as forms were offered, signed, witnessed. And then they started out and left the home she had never known, past trees bare and white, past people moving slowly on the icy streets, and children's eyes looking up. They could have, and sometimes they do. That's one of the hardest things, is know when to stop. And you take your chances. You think you know you're right, and you never know. If it goes on too long, you may give the reader a little more information, a little more to go on, and you may have a better poem. You may wind up writing a short story. Or you may wind up giving the reader too much, and then there's no aesthetic distance. There's no room. It's like saying, "Let me show you my scar." Well, we've all got scars. So you've got to pick that spot where you don't explain it all, and yet you give enough to get them to the situation.
I was reading Todd from Bound of Heaven this afternoon, and I thought, oh, this thing went on much too long.
Yeah, yeah, they often do. 19th century went on and on. Victorians. That's a good point. When do you stop? If you're dealing with a form, of course, and rhyme, if you're writing a sonnet, you know darn well when to stop. When you get to 14 lines, that's it. You better have done it. But when you're writing a free verse, there's nobody around to tell you when to stop. Now, Robert Frost turned up his nose at free verse. You know, he said, writing poems without rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. Well, that's fine if you're Robert Frost and you have that sort of facility with rhyme and meter. But I happen to like free verse. I think it's easier to tell a story, at least just for me. Well, I'll read you a sonnet, shall I? Just for, by way of, is a series of poems I wrote for an American poet named Mark Van Doren. Some of you may know his name. He lived in Connecticut and he taught at Columbia University for 40 years, and he had a farm in Cornwall Hollow, Connecticut, northwest part. And I wrote some poems for him. And this is to go spring, summer, and winter. Now this is the winter one, and it's a sonnet. It's called Winter Dreams. And it's the kind, it's the type of sonnet where every line rhymes, every two lines rhyme. Those rolling, rolling clouds of dark and light that spread themselves across the autumn night, those chilling winds that cut the tops of trees, blowing leaves and faces as they please, and coating winter water mirror bright with frosted crust that's only slightly glazed, this whistling wind that bends through branches blazed by orange, reds, and blues and drifting leaves, runs heavy crested on the hill and grieves like eyes that stare open wide and dazed. These clouds and winds I see in winter dreams, they race and sing, then leaping up so high a pale white moon is struck, or so it seems, and silver stars are scattered in the sky. So I deal with form. And here's, I'll just read another one while I'm at it. It's called Autumn Amber to Mark Van Doren. This is a three stanzas. It's not a sonnet, but it has rhyme and form and all. This again is fall. Only those hours, those sweet, sweet hours that float amber in the late day's sun, only those hours bring the smell of coal dust black on the gold Midwestern air. Just at autumn, the wind amid flowers sets that darkening sky adrift. Clouds run through golden streamers, flecking rust on leaves that wander everywhere. Just there in that autumn amber, in the rows of smoke and leaves, in just that time I remember amber dreams a poet weaves. Yeah, I sure do. Yeah, I haven't read that in a decade. It's called The Salt Lick at Daybreak in Holden Village. Behind Chalet 1 is a salt lick, and the deer come over there. They're blue salt now, I see, the blocks of salt. When I was a kid on the farm, my cousin and I used to pretend we were cows, and we'd go around licking salt all the time. My Aunt Emma would come after us with a switch and say, "Don't you kids have any more sense than to do that?" And the cows have been licking it. And she'd go away, then they said, "Well, if we're not supposed to be cows, we'll pretend we're pigs." So we took off our clothes and we'd get in the hog waller, kind of muck about with the pigs. And she'd come out with a switch again and said, we couldn't figure out what kind of animal she wanted us to be. No cows, no pigs. Took all the fun out of it just being boys. If you've never been in a hog waller, you'd miss something. Thankfully, huh? All right, this is the Salt Lick at Daybreak, Holden Village, Washington, 1974. Well, that tells you where that is. The salt block stands like a lamp. The long tongues reach out of the trees and caress the corners of the salt. The mountains move forward, press against the thing. The ground sucks through fern hairs that move in blind orgiastic circles, and low moans escape the shards of rock and limb that cannot come. The feast glides on tripod feet, clicking on stars, dropping bits of salt on the mucus leaves. And morning comes like sudden sparrows to peck and scratch, and the mountains pull back down their glacier gullies, the trees bend backwards toward cool deeps, and the long tongues slide after the deer who move in light from bark and stone. Mm-hmm. See, that's sort of a nice poem. I read that in 10 years. Yeah, it's not bad. If a poet is allowed to say that about his own stuff. Any questions you'd like to ask or comments, really? No dreams that I know of. Although the only time that's ever happened that I can remember is when I wrote The Death, that trilogy. I wrote The Auction and the Home over a decade ago, and they were published in a magazine together. And then a decade later, I dreamed about the old woman dying. So I got up and wrote that. That's the only time that happens. It's a very poetic, romantic thing to think about doing that. And sometimes it works that way, but I must admit it's very rare. Usually you just have to work harder. Yeah. But it's all autobiographical. T.S. Eliot said a poet should not be found in his poetry. Subscribe to that. I don't think it's possible. I don't think any artist can keep out of his work. The trick is to not be in there and muck about with combat boots and stomp all over so nobody else can have any fun with it. T.S. Eliot, the best thing he did say was that you've got to find the objective correlative. You've got to find some objective thing that correlates to the subjective thing you're feeling. If all you have is emotion, nobody, so what? It's got to be objectified, into, and then it becomes art, and then everybody can enjoy it. That's the tough part. So you start with your own experience, and hopefully, Robert Frost, as usual, said it best, a poem should begin in delight and end in wisdom. Very tough to do. So yeah, I would say probably 95% of all the stuff is autobiographical. And there's always some poems that somebody will say something or I'll see something and make it up. I've lost a little weight up here at Holden Village. Poor Dan, you get suckered into all these neat questions. I could pick on Dan. I've been working with him for 2 weeks here. So I can. Good question, very briefly. I've been writing plays. I've written 3 plays and a bunch of short stories over the last 2 or 3 years. So the stuff is becoming a little more narrative, a little longer. There may be a novel somewhere, but not yet, but probably more short stories. I hope some more plays. The poems continue to be 90% about the Midwest. I doubt if that's ever going to change, even though I've lived in California since 1940. I doubt if that's going to change. I don't write many California poems. Even though I grew up there, I was a scuba diver on the coast for 15 years. I've had all millions of adventures. But the poems are still back in Hole in the Ice and Cobbler Pies and things like that. Yeah?
What writers are you reading now, short story novels?
I like Flannery O'Connor a lot. I like the poetry of Galway Kinnell a great deal. Robert Bly, Minnesota poet. Galway Kinnell won the Pulitzer Prize this year, or last year. He's very good. I like him a lot. I like Robert Frost and Whitman and Emily Dickinson better than anybody. I think they're just super. English poets, I like Tennyson. I like the sound of Tennyson. I like Longfellow. Very old-fashioned in that regard. I have this graduate professor, Ulf, says, I had a class in University of Nebraska in modern poetry, in American poetry. He said, well, we'll skip Longfellow. I said, why? He's passé. He rhymes, you know. So what? So does Shakespeare. We don't skip him. Is there another hand?
You mentioned that you're writing these different things. I don't know exactly how to ask this question, but how do you find it coming to you in different ways? A play, a novel, poetry?
Mm-hmm.
Do you work on some of these things as hard work, or do some of the things just flow, or what?
I do. It's kind of a two-part question. First of all, if I think I want to write a play, I'll try to hear the voices. Now, did you see Ulysses the other night?
Yes.
Well, that was written sort of by accident. When I was up here in 81 on sabbatical, they said, direct a play. So I said, okay, I'll direct Our Town or Spoon River Anthology. I couldn't find the plays, and I looked all over the village, and I couldn't find them. So I went back to my chalet, and I wrote Ulysses. I came out the next day and I said, here's the play. And I said, oh, we forgot to tell you, the script library is upstairs. Now, if I had known that, I would never have written Ulysses. So that was just an accident, and the play turned out. Then I went home and wrote 2 more. I started hearing voices. I mean, not like a mystical thing at all, but my aunts talking, my uncles, my father, my brother, whoever, you know, just to try to pick, you hear sounds. You know, you grow up hearing sounds as a child. It's just a matter of sitting there and catching that nuance of voice. And if the more dialogue you hear, the more likely you are to write a story or a play, if you hear a lot of dialogue. If you hear a little dialogue, but mostly you see a patch of snow getting dirty, like February snow, or like when I was a kid in December, I used to come up to a rut and put my foot on it very softly and evenly, and then watch the little cracks kind of fan out, or the sun going down. If you see images, you're more likely to think about a poem if it's image. If it's voice, you're probably going to be writing a story. Or if you want to tell a story, it's obvious you want to tell a story. I forgot the second part of your question. Does it come easily? Very rarely. Some come very fast. Some come lickety-split, and it's all you can. I write on the typewriter because I can type very fast. I make a ton of mistakes, but I type fast. And so I can do that pretty fast. And some of them come real fast. I would say maybe 15, 20% of them. The rest are just bloody hard work. Anything else? Don't want to keep you past Vespers. So we've got one more poem. Okay, this is called Gethsemane Abbey. I wrote this down in, I've been reading Thomas Merton a lot, and Seven Story Mountain and a ton of stuff. And so I made a retreat at the monastery last year and got up at 3:30 in the morning and did all the things that the monks did, these Trappist monks down there. And it was a very moving experience to have been there in the monastery. So I wrote the poem called Gethsemane Abbey. The late sun on the leaves dapples the white crosses beside the old walls. Tonight the moon will be full again, and I will lie awake thinking of you, my God, wondering if I can go home now, if a week is long enough to burn my sins out of me, whether praying the hours at 3:15 in the morning in the cold church is enough, watching the brothers in the light of the candles, waiting for Mass on my knees, listening for God. Are there other Protestants here? I don't know the rosary, but find the holy water cool on my forehead. And Father Michael moves from the shadows, bringing Christ to me, watching me closely, holding me with his eyes. It has started to rain. Tomorrow the leaves will be wet in the retreatant's garden, but the old brother will be there on his knees among the shrubs, lost to his brother's world in Cincinnati, touching the earth reverently like a lover, gently opening the fronds. And I watch from the window of the bus back to Louisville, full of light and unusual prayers, going back where I know the liturgy, among familiar groves of thought, until the trees hide the abbey in fold upon fold of sweet Kentucky hills, and the white crosses, and the old brother beautifully lost there in the damp garden of God. Thanks for coming.